Welcome to Cross Defense. The apologetic show is for inquiring minds of all ages. Rod Zwanenzer, your host, broadcasting live from the International Center of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, St. Louis, Missouri, USA. We are excited to be bringing this new show to you. This is the second edition because people have legitimate questions about Christianity. And we have people that want to try to give down-to-earth, reliable, true answers to those questions. Today, we're going to talk about this. What do college kids think about Christianity and truth? And to help us through that is a campus pastor, Pastor Ian Pacey. He's campus pastor at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And Ian, you're also serve at a congregation there in Tucson, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
The name of the church?
Catalina Lutheran Church.
Right in Tucson itself?
Yeah, it's right in Tucson. Tucson's kind of a largest city in terms of how spread out it is. So we're 20 miles north of the university in northwestern Tucson.
Great city, Tucson. Early in my first career as a marketing guy, I spent a lot of time in Tucson at the University of Arizona. Great place. Love the university. Besides Pastor Pacey as an important guest today, you are as well. That's our listener anywhere in the world because we want to hear from you. We want to hear your questions and your comments to today's program, your apologetic questions, your apologetic comments. You can do so by phoning us in the St. Louis listening area, 314-821-0850, worldwide, 800-730-2727. I know we were having some problems, some issues with that 800 number over the weekend and this morning, so I hope we got it fixed. Or you can email us at kfuo@kfuo.org. Ian, you work with college kids to a great part of your day, and where are college kids these days with truth? I know that the kind of the cultural times being postmodern, that people don't think of the truth as they used to. Where are our campus kids, students, with this idea of truth in our day?
Yeah, that's a great question. excuse me. When it comes to students, you know, first we're going to want to make sure we don't broad brush all students, and that students have different kinds of perspectives and different ways of coming at the question. And our hope is that with Christian students, they have a pretty solid grasp of truth, that it exists, that it's attainable. And hopefully even the means by which one might come to attain or come to know something to be true. But my experience with students, say now, who are non-Christians, just the, you know, garden variety student coming up to a table or talking with them in some circumstance there on campus, truth is very much on the downturn in that they're not so sure that we can actually know true things. So it's definitely postmodern. And if there's anything that really is true in their experience, and this is really because of what's going on at U of A, they might limit that truth or being able to find truth to just something that we can find, say, by way of the hard sciences. University of Arizona is a very hard science-oriented school, physics, biology, chemistry, those sorts of things. So they might be willing to say, okay, that's true, because we've established it here in the classroom and we've established it in the lab, and we're using, say, scientific method to come to that truth, so it's reproducible, et cetera, et cetera. Almost anything outside of the hard sciences, they're very skeptical and are willing to just say that, you know, what's true for you is not necessarily true for me. And that's broad brush there on their part. It would be broad brush in the sense of it doesn't matter what it is, flavors of ice cream, Christian faith, makes no difference. Anything outside of the hard sciences is all up for grabs, and each individual person then is left to sort it out on their own.
You know, what's weird for me to hear that, Ian, is I can remember very distinctly, and, you know, I just have to categorize myself as the baby boomer that mm-hmm. I am, that, you know, growing up in high school, you know, of course, that was the big thing, was the race to the moon. And we were engaged in that with our arch enemy, the Soviet Union, back then. And so we were told this specifically in high school and then in college, that science was advancing so fast that they were going to fix all the big challenging problems that we had in the world. So it's almost like that, you know, science promised us that the world is going to get better because of all of these wonderful advances in technology and science. And, you know, let's be clear on that, that we thank God for technology. We thank God for science. But, you know, when you start to take science and make it into the only thing that counts, the only thing that is real, the only thing that can determine truth, I think we have some issues to talk about with that. And apologetics likes and needs to do that, doesn't it? You know, it's almost like maybe we can start off with this one, Ian. How do you teach people what a God is? Because I think everybody has a God. That's my opinion, at least. Everybody has a God. It's just how you define a God. How would you teach people what a God is?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I would start out with the question of God and how we think about God and discuss God. One of the issues I have, or we have...
I wasn't thinking so much the true God, but I was thinking more in terms of a little God with a little g.
Oh, I see your point.
Yeah, or you could say a worldview. We could go with that one, right?
Yeah, definitely so.
A worldview might be better with a non-believer to go for. If their worldview is of a closed universe where the only thing that's going to be believable and trusted in with any reliability is the hard sciences. And you were explaining that really well for us, Ian, that, you know, it's like chemistry, physics, biology, those things that we used to call them the physical sciences, as opposed to the social sciences, like psychology, sociology, anthropology, that kind of thing, right? That's the split?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That worldview that all that is science, you know, it does not solve everything. That was my point.
Indeed.
I can tell you right off the bat that I was raised, went to college in the early 60s, a turbulent time. We all know that. It's historic, that revolutionary times, that, you know, you're talking almost 50 years. Wow, I'm getting old, since I was in college. But they promised that none of the issues that we have today should be around because science was going to fix them.
Oh, yeah, indeed. This is the narrative that goes with the Star Trek trilogies, that this was the world that we were working toward, where poverty was solved and all sorts of malice was solved, and it was all by putting our heads together and, you know, by way of politics and science and these sorts of things, we've eliminated any need for God in the sense of, he was a pure fabrication in the past that made life a little bit easier, but now that we solved problems that we used to, say, give over to God that he would handle, like deliver us from this flood or deliver us from this plague, now we have science to deliver us from these things and we no longer need God. That's the Star Trek kind of narrative. Yeah.
And, you know, we a lot of us embrace this thing, Ian. I remember one time sitting in a cab, a yellow cab in Denver, Colorado, coming out of a business meeting. And there was a blizzard, a massive blizzard in Denver, and I was going back to the airport, and so this cab driver and I started talking, and you know, he was talking about the snowflakes, you know, and he says to me something like, you know, science is just amazing, but they can't seem to control the weather, and I was thinking, well, you know, and so I started this discussion with him about the massive wind channels that are up on the top, you know, and when they shift, these high up wind streams, it affects all the weather and all the earth.
For sure.
And I said, does any scientist understand where they come from, what changes them, what moves them? And he was like, wow, I never thought of that. And so I was sharing with him, you know, Job, sure, where God says that, hey, I control all of this. I know where all this is, you know, and kind of put Job in a position that I think some scientists are, that we don't know really where those wind currents, where they begin, where they shift, how they shift. I remember a story even supposedly that the Russians tried to change these and couldn't figure it out because they wanted to affect agriculture. But we know the weather affects so much. I mean, look at the mass destruction the change in weather can do around our world. We scientists can't seem to control or predict all these things really well. And so I used that with that gentleman to kind of open up this idea that, you know, scientists can't seem to fix everything or predict everything, but maybe the direction we want to go, and maybe even some of our listeners might want to jump in here, is I guess what you're saying is that within college campuses, so many of the students are starting to believe that science is the great determiner of everything, and outside of it nothing else can be trusted. And you know, in my own lifetime, what I'm suggesting is they've really deceived me and a lot of other people in time. Because, you know, we should not see the problems that we have with cancer anymore or with all these other diseases. They should have wiped those out. As you said, poverty, you know, they should have affected the weather. And you know, why are so many kids starving around the world? Science does great things, don't get me wrong, but what we're building up here and we want to talk about is science, all that there is that's important and truthful.
Yes, that's the issue. So, you know, coming back to the worldview question, what my experience is with students is a lot of students have a kind of a worldview, and it's just not very well thought through or well informed, in the sense that they put a lot of trust in science, and they put a lot of trust in the kind of evidence you get from science, you know, the facts, so to speak. And they are willing to, say, in a discussion, discount every other kind of knowing here. But if you just dig one inch below the surface here, you'll find there's all kinds of assumptions, all kinds of ways of handling life, where they are, in fact, trusting in certain things, even trusting with their lives in certain things, like when they cross the road. There's nobody out there with a wind gauge or a, you know, some kind of an instrument to determine whether the car is actually real or not. They take it on their senses alone, and they make that leap of faith by walking across the street, trusting fully in their senses. And so we had out here a few years ago a professor who teaches at MIT, runs one of their physics labs. His name is Dr. Ian Hutchinson. And his position was basically this: science, and he fully believes in it, has a role, and it brings us a certain kind of knowledge. Knowledge of the natural world. But there are other kinds of information out there. There are other kinds of truths out there that can only be grasped using other means. And so the example he used was the example of, say, the love of his wife. You know, he doesn't take his wife to work with him and subject her to experiments in the physics lab. You know, he doesn't check to see if her body is getting warmer or colder as he stands nearer or farther from her or anything like that. But rather, it's his experience with his wife, conversation with his wife, how they treat one another, how they act around one another. All these things together give him a kind of an evidence that, yes, indeed, and good for him, his wife loves him. And so there are ways of coming to knowing things, and strictly speaking, you're not using the scientific method. The one I like, I mean, that's definitely a good one, but the one I like is when we think about, say, the law. Because what we have with the law and what we have, say, with a court, and we have a case, and we have prosecutor, and we have a defender, is we have a kind of a system in place where we're using all sorts of evidences, and some of them are just historical evidences. There's no chance that this is going to be anything that we could subject to the lab and figure out what's going on one way or the other. But when you have a court case, you have very specific rules for evidence. It's a kind of a science, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there are people in the law who specialize in cross-examination and how you treat and you handle evidence. And what we say is we can take eyewitness testimony, we can take this and that and all these things and put them together, and we can basically figure out, given enough evidence, what actually happened. So there's a way of working in the direction of truth. It doesn't have that exact same 100% reproducibility angle to it that, say, the sciences have. But for the most part, we will say, yeah, if you put 12 people in there, you give them this evidence, and they all together agree, then, yeah, we can say that person, they were able to discover in advance, or after the fact, whether that person was innocent or guilty. And to me, that's a strong kind of of an apologetic here that a lot of students will listen to, because I don't really think, yeah, what is the court system? The court system is about a question here that's up in the air. We don't know the answer, whether it's yes or no. You know, there's a presumption of innocence so we can have the case. And then going through these evidences, and it won't be using the physical tools that we're expressing here. It's this back and forth. It's dialogue. It's history. Yeah, okay, after all of that, we can say that person was guilty, and that person should suffer the consequences, or that person was not guilty, and that person should be definitely released.
Yeah, I think what you're suggesting, Ian, is that, you know, history is something that's not really open in most cases to that, you know, scientific experimentation and, empirical, evaluation. And yet we trust in history and the trial with the evidences that you're talking about, witnesses, that kind of fits into that same frame that you know, we look for truth among reliable, credible witnesses and other evidence. I remember I was in a jury with it was a murder trial, potential murder trial, and at the very end, the district attorney looked at the potential jury members and asked, "How many of you watch CSI?" Mm. And I was one that hadn't, but the majority of people raised their hands, and he said, "How many of you believe that every trial should have evidence like you see on CSI and TV?" And there were a few that did. He had them all dismissed because he told the rest of us, very few trials ever have that kind of evidence.
Indeed.
He said, so you're bringing up a really good point that history and our legal system relies on more than just scientific evidence, and we ought to believe in it. I mean, because so much of our current beliefs and everything are built on history, and we should believe in reliable history. So I like what you're going with that.
Yeah, indeed, that's just the point, is that there's different ways of coming to truth, and there's different ways of getting at different kinds of truths. The lab is going to be different than the courtroom, but they're both working in the direction of truth. That's what the major point is here.
Sure. Now, in this regard, Ian, I want to know, on campuses today, are they open to other opinions other than their own? Are they kind of what you call closed-minded to anything outside this hard physical scientific evidence?
You know, this is the blessing and bane of the postmodern kind of thinking, is that in some ways it has opened people up to things beyond the material, beyond the natural. In the sense, speaking of religion, let's say the spiritual world, broadly conceived. But on the other hand, you know, what goes with postmodernism is the understanding that each person is working out for themselves their own reality and their own meaning. And of course, that's absolutely not true and totally unworkable in the real world. So it's one of those things where students will come up and they're willing to talk, they're willing to discuss, but it is hard, to the point of frustration, making headway with students, because they've always got this sort of out, well, okay, that's true for him and it's working for him, but I'm not necessarily bound to believe that at all. Even if I'm trying to make the case that these are universal things, we all have to believe these things, we're all governed by these things in the way, say, the physical laws govern us. Postmodernism has put that position there where that's not in their minds, it's not necessarily true.
Not true for all times or all peoples,
no.
Right? So you can pick and choose what works for you, what you want to have as truth. Is that kind of where
it's
at?
That's what it is, yeah. Over time, people's opinions change, and so truth changes in that same way.
So they're open to other beliefs and truths, but not really any absolute truth would be for all times, for all peoples.
Yeah, no, this, of course, again, is broad brushing. But generally speaking, yeah, that's the kind of thing that's in the water now.
Mm-hmm. Do they see science and Christianity as incompatible? Does that come up at all that, you know, Christianity really doesn't embrace true science, or they're at war? You know, I know some of the scientist side, you know, where we would say they have a worldview that's exclusively scientific, they would say we are incompatible.
Indeed.
And a lot of Christians would argue, no, they are compatible if you look at the real thing on both sides. What are college kids kind of coming out on that one, Ian?
Yeah, this is a huge question. Typically, and I just polled some of my students last week, you know, preparing for the show in a way so I'd have fresh material and could tell you, you know, what I've just recently heard. And this was the first thing that came up and was the most commonly held and, you know, kind of experienced thing among students is that I have some pretty sharp students who are working there on a science degree. Most of them are going off to med school or something like that. And when their friends find out or the professors find out that they're Christians, almost to a person, the response is that can't be possible. You're too smart to be a Christian. Christianity's basically for dopey people who are easily taken in by silly stories. You know, how is it that you could be both a Christian holding to scientific method and all those kinds of things, and at the same time, a scientist and also a Christian, you know, essentially easy believing in a Bible that's just what they consider to be legendary, kind of ridiculous stuff. So there is some animosity there, for sure. Broadly speaking, in the academy, there's a professor who teaches up at ASU, so just north of us, not the U of A. His name is Lawrence Krauss. And at ASU, they have an institute called the Origins Institute. And essentially what the Origins Institute has done is made this a place where, it's essentially, let's get to the point, it's an institute where they're researching this question and developing the idea that the sciences is the place where the smart people go, and it's liberating us from religion in all of its, you know, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and all those kinds of things. This is a place where, say, Richard Dawkins will come every year and give a speech and a talk to folks to kind of rev them up. But mainly the point is to say that if you get in the sciences, there's absolutely no place for you in the sciences if you are also a Christian.
Yeah, if they, like you say, if they discover it and they wonder how such a bright young person can choose a mythological basis like that. Well, we'd love some of you college students out there or former college students or college students to be would communicate with us. We're talking today about what do college students really think about Christianity and truth. And our guest is Pastor Ian Pacey. He's the campus pastor for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod there at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's also the assistant coordinator for LCMSU, a great new thing that we've started at our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. You can check that out on their website, lcms.u. You can find if there's a chapter near you and check it out. It's a great thing. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to move on to some other topics, views of women, sex, morals, all kinds of things that college kids are really into. And I know these seem to not be just what college kids are into, but which the society at large is into, Ian. So we're looking forward to talking about that on the other side. Call us in the St. Louis area, 314-821-0850, worldwide, 800-730-2727. Or we'd love to hear your email, kfuo@kfuo.org. You're listening to Cross Defense, where we hope to engage in intellectual questions about the faith, because inquiring minds of all ages, not just college kids, want to talk about these. So we're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we're going to do more of this. Cross Defense, you're listening to Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Hi, I'm Andy Bates. Join me for the next Faith and Family, where we'll talk with experts and everyday people about topics pertinent to faithful family life. Listen to Faith and Family Live weekdays at 11 on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, underwritten by Concordia University, Wisconsin.
Johann Sebastian Bach once said, "The aim and final end of all music should be none other than the glory of God and the refreshment of the soul." We're providing some glorious refreshment 24 hours a day online at classic99.com. Great classical music and sacred classics originating from these historic studios of KFUO Radio. Check us out, classic99.com, a ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
Author Tim Gagline, who served as the special assistant to President George W. Bush, talks about the importance of KFUO.
KFUO is in the middle of the culture. And if you want to impact culture, you have to be in it. I think that we owe the best that is within us to our country, culture, and civilization. And now with the advent of the internet, to the world. How do we find new ways to the rising generation of young Americans to share the good news of Jesus' birth, death, and resurrection? How do we use our moral imagination? How do we use creativity to get the word out? That's what it's all about. That's what KFUO is doing. It is making it new. It's saying, here is our great legacy and our great heritage as Lutherans who are privileged and honored to live in this country. I love KFUO for that reason.
On the radio, online, and on demand, worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Next to the Word of God, the noble art of music is the greatest treasure in the world. Martin Luther said that, and we believe it. That's why we're presenting those great musical treasures online at classic99.com. Why don't you check us out? classic99.com, classical music and sacred classics 24 hours a day, a ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
Facebook is a great way to keep up with programming and get a behind-the-scenes glimpse into the broadcast day of KFUO Radio. This is where you'll find the inside scoop on programming and show links, photos, videos, and get details of upcoming events. And it's the place where you can connect with us and other listeners. And it's just so easy. Go to Facebook on your computer or smart device, put KFUO into the search box, select our page, and like us today. And oh yes, it's totally free. So what are you waiting for?
In death, Nelson Mandela has unified South Africans in prayers of remembrance. Mandela was honored Sunday in churches that resisted white domination, as well as those that once supported apartheid. The congregation at St. George's Cathedral in Cape Town prayed that South Africans can realize their former president's long walk to freedom. Cathedral parishioner Pierre Kotsi says,
"In the 1980s, it was one of the places where people could come of all races and backgrounds in Cape Town. Not even all of them were necessarily Christian, by the way, and I think it's just St. George's is the right place to do this in Cape Town."
At Johannesburg's Regina Mundi Church, the Reverend Sebastian Rousseau compared Mandela to the prophets Isaiah and John the Baptist, calling him moonlight in the dark night. In Pretoria, Dutch Reformed Church pastor Nicky Lamprecht said Mandela changed attitudes in his overwhelmingly white denomination. A massive memorial for Mandela will be held in Johannesburg Tuesday. I'm Steve Coleman.
Welcome back to Cross Defense, the apologetic show for inquiring minds of all ages. I'm your host, Rod Zwanisser, talking with Pastor Ian Pacey. He's a pastor there at the University of Arizona in Tucson. We're talking about what do college kids think about Christianity and the truth today. We just got through talking about their interest in and relationship between science and the Christian faith. Let's move on to another topic, Ian, that the college students are into these days.
Sounds good.
Where would you like to take us next now that we did science?
Okay, well, you know, one of the things, and this goes to worldview again, if I'm out on a table or I'm in some other situation again where a student will have access to me, you'd think that the questions you're going to receive first are going to be problem of evil or, you know, something along those lines, the kind of philosophical question where you have real unbelief sort of pitted against belief in Christianity. But it turns out, and I think the reason for this is that people in general, it's not just students, all people, just are not as reflective about philosophical positions and why I believe this and those sorts of things. And so it ends up, I get a lot of questions that go to things that students will observe, say, in the newspaper, because they don't read newspapers, but they'll see online and they'll see contact points where Christianity and society are at odds. And so one of the first places that ends up being is the question of life and the question of abortion. Because when you look at people, look at the groups that tend to be the pro-life side, they're Roman Catholics, they're Christians, folks with religious beliefs. And on the other side, then it'll be atheists and folks of that nature. Now, of course, there's crossover, don't get me wrong. Amazingly, there are Christians who somehow come to believe in the propriety of abortion, and then the reverse is true, atheists who are opposed to abortion. But generally speaking, what you see on TV. And so just walking by, the kind of pot shot will be is, I don't know what's wrong with you guys. How come you guys can't support a woman's right to choose? Don't you think people should have choices in life? And so that's one place in particular. It's not really very heavily philosophical, but it just sort of shows people, students here in particular, who really don't know where Christians are coming from. And because of that, and this is worldview, they just don't understand our position. They think it's more out of being traditional, being sort of, just old school in that sense, and not having a real belief or a kind of a foundation that says, these are the reasons why we're opposed to abortion. These are the reasons why we support life for the unborn child.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a factor, maybe even a significant factor, that the media paints this polarized issue and controversy between the Christians and the pro-choice people, and doesn't really get into a lot of the really good discussion of just that, they pick out as they are prone to do for the the media time that they present this stuff, the more sensational. And so, I'm wondering if any of these students are even aware that Dr. Robert George of Princeton, he's did this really neat book. I interviewed him on this one, Ian. It's called Embryo in Defense Of, where he says he's going to prove in this book, and he's not going to use the Bible at all or any religion, that scientists today have come to the conclusion that at conception, that is a human life. That's not the debate anymore. And I'm thinking, that's fantastic for apologetics, that if that's true, and I see no reason to believe that what he presents there is not true, that most of the hard sciences are now, along with us, saying that life really does start at conception. And so that's what we're concerned about, aren't we? It's not we're anti-woman, that we're anti-choice. We are pro-life. We all are about bringing life to its full, and we're also about protecting the most weak among us. And so I'm wondering if that is has any awareness out there.
Oh yeah, definitely so. This is the thing that's now part of the conversation, and that we have, going back to our conversation earlier on, we have science here that helps us to work through some of the issues that are going on in the womb. I mean, previously, I remember when I was in college and even in high school, there was this kind of idea that the all the phases of evolution were taking place in gestation, so it became, started as a fish and became a chicken and became a higher-ordered creature, and then finally it was born as a human. And of course, this is all preposterous and ridiculous now, but there was a time, based on the philosophy of evolution, that they thought that was what was going on.
Even had those false embryological drawings from that guy Geckel in Germany, which even show up in a bunch of science textbooks.
Indeed.
That are totally falsified,
Totally.
Yeah,
The big idea here with this question, now this does get into theology, gets into how we look at the world, is to say, okay, fine. You hold to a woman's choice being the most important thing. The question is, what are you saying when you defend the idea of choice? How do you come to believe or hold the idea of choice being the most important thing here? And typically where the argument goes is it goes down the line of some form of human dignity. This is a human person. They have certain rights. And so choice then becomes, the expression of that right, and we have to defend that. And for our purposes in the discussion, the idea of going to human dignity is really quite helpful, because human dignity is, in fact, what we are all about in this question. The question then turns to, you have choice and you have this human person here. If we're able to demonstrate, and we can quite easily, life begins when you have, the consumption of carbohydrates and you have this, that, and everything else. So in the womb, 1 second after that life form in the womb begins, it has a different set of DNA. It's got different genetics, based on mother and father, but clearly different. It's taking in energy. It's putting out other things, heat, and so on and so forth. So it is, in fact, a life. And the question is we don't believe in life in the abstract, is what kind of life is it? Is it a fish? Is it a giraffe? Well, no, as it turns out, it's a human life. The only difference is the level of gestation where it happens to be. It's only 1 week old, and this is what you should expect a one-week-old human being to look like in the womb. And in 10 years, it'll look different. In 20 years, it'll look different. In 50 years, it'll look different. At the end of its life, it looks different. But in terms of core and what it's about, in terms of DNA, it's always the same.
Yeah, that's a good stream that you're going on there, that it's not a potential person. It's a person right now with a lot of the same set that any of us have. It's just it's not as far along as we are, and you know, what right do we have to destroy its right to become a full, lead a life? And so that's a good does that start to move the discussion helpfully, Ian, is what you're saying?
I think it does, because people, it's hard to say why they believe this when they don't have a religious position as a foundation here, but people do generally hold to the dignity of the human being. And so if you're able to frame the question as not a single human being and a potential human being, but two human beings, and how do you work out this situation now with the two human beings in the picture, it does bring strength to the position of life, and that you've already said the reason why you think the woman should have a choice, or does have a choice in this sense, is because she's a person and she has rights and so on and so forth. And so then you're able to take that those values and take that way of looking at the argument and then apply them to the human person who is in the womb and say, why should their rights be any less than say the mother's rights and those sorts of things? I hate to put this so crassly, but that's essentially how the argument goes back and forth.
Yeah, and I'd like to kind of flow this into the next topic, and I'd like to invite our listeners out there to participate. They can call in 314-821-0850 or 800-730-2727 or email at kfuo@kfuo.org. The next topic, same sex and marriage, kind of interfaces with our discussion about abortion, Ian, because sex is all where this starts.
Right.
And I realized even in my parish experience that the high school kids, and even down in middle, were more sexually active than I ever even thought about at their age. And so I realize now when they get to college, a lot of these kids are pretty experienced sexually, And so, they think of Christians, you tell me, as kind of bigots here. And I looked up the dictionary definition of a bigot is a person who is utterly intolerant of any differing creed, belief, or opinion.
Oh yeah.
So, in a way, I can see where these young people really see us Christians as utterly intolerant of anything that clashes with what we think is the truth, and that would really apply to sex and marriage. Give us a little bit more of where the kids are at on that topic.
Yeah, this has been a worldview thing once again, in that. Not just our students, generally speaking, were sexually active, but even among Christian students, say, who are not sexually active, among their friends and their peers, there's just a general endorsement of same-sex relationships and same-sex marriages. And it's very much related to the pro-life abortion discussion, in that it hinges on human dignity once again. And this is not something that Christians have made up as a kind of apologetic for discussing this particular issue. It comes from those who hold to this, and this is a part of their defense or their rationale, is they say, look, you have two people here who have human dignity. They have human value, have human worth. They love each other. How is it that you as Christians who claim that God is love could be opposed to same-sex relationships and same-sex marriages? I mean, if that's the case, then you must not be very good Christians, because God, after all, again, is love. One way that I tried to begin to discuss this with my own students, meaning mostly Christian students, if not all Christian students in the campus ministry, is to go back to Genesis chapter 1 and work through those first two or three chapters. And that's essentially what we did for the whole of this semester, is we worked through those first three chapters of Genesis, those foundational texts, and laid out there what life is and why it's good, because God created it and declared it to be so. Laid out what the relationship between the male and the female happened to be, Genesis 2, and then how it's teased out in detail there in chapter 3. And prominent in chapter 3 there is the fact that Adam is the one who doesn't have the appropriate spouse, and all of the it's during the naming, all of the animals are brought before him, and at the end of it, it says there was no suitable helpmate found for him there. And then God is the one who creates Eve as the suitable and perfect helpmate for him, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. And so when we talk about love, you know, we as Christians now, and I realize there's a whole gap here, because you have to invest authority in the scriptures and why we think those are places to go for these kinds of answers. But saying, okay, we've settled those questions and now we trust the scriptures. You know, right there you have a whole theology of love, and that there's a proper form of love and then there's an improper form of love that even the unbeliever, for the most part, or people who are not Christians will recognize. That love is more than just, say, warm fuzzies, but the relationship that the word love tries to capture here really only works properly and appropriately in certain ways. So there are certain things that people will just say, even as unbeliever, well, those aren't appropriate forms of love. And this is actually where the debate's going in our society. People are saying, once we provide for a legal acceptance of same-sex marriage, what's going to keep us from polyamorous marriages? What's going to keep us from people marrying their pets or their cars,
incest,
or a bridge,
all
or,
of that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so that all then goes back to is you really have to define love. And when we go down that road of defining love, most people will buy into the biblical description of love.
So you're saying when you take them back, you use their assumption there that God is love.
Yeah.
You build on that and you take off from that. Ian, I was going to ask you this. I host a book review program it's on Fridays now at this same time slot. And this Friday, I'm going to have the great privilege of interviewing a theologian who wrote a great book on this, The Bible and Homosexual Practice. And he has this great sentence, and I wanted to ask you what you thought of this.
Who's the author?
Robert Gagnon.
Oh, sure.
And he writes this sentence, and I thought this is really good as an apologetic. In sum, it is not hard to see the wisdom of God in sanctioning only heterosexual unions. Because he says that there are at least five major negative effects of opening it up to homo, bi, or sexual, or transgender.
Sure.
And so he goes, increase in serious health problems, including but not limited to HIV, AIDS, hepatitis, rectal cancer, substance abuse, mental illness, depression, suicide, and decreased life expectancy. Increase in the incidence of same-sex pedophilia and adult adolescent inappropriate sexual activity. Erosion in ecclesiastical and societal expectations of long-term monogamous relationships. Thus, a cheapening of the fabric of society, marriage and family. Annihilation of all societal gender norms. The public, political, educational, professional, and legal marginalization of any who make known their opposition to this. I thought this is pretty good. You know, for an apologetic, we're not even talking Bible here. We're just talking the effects of this looseness on sex. You know, and I wonder if you get the chance to share with these young college students, Ian, as I did with people when I was in the parish, that, you know, some people like to paint God and us Christians as not being pro-sex. And we say, God loves sex. It's a great gift to us, right? Like procreation. How are we going to continue to create human beings without male-female relations?
Right. Hey, it's a command. Be fruitful and multiply.
Absolutely. And so when you were saying taking back there to the first three chapters in Genesis, Gagnon here in his book likes that too. And so it's like God knows what's best for us in this sex. And so he wants it to be the very best enjoyment and procreation and honored thing among us. And I think we've lost track of that. And you know, maybe just to talk about those things that are harmful to all of culture, not just to the church.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Full disclosure, I have two of Gagnon's works. I think he's a professor at Pitt.
He is. That's the same guy, yes.
Yeah, and he's great. I read his stuff online, his blog, I read his books, and he has good exegetical work here in the discussion of, say, the homosexual practice and the Bible. I think that's the name of one of the books.
Yes, yeah, I think that's one I'm doing Friday.
Yeah, so, indeed, and they're great. They're great resources. He's not Lutheran, he's Presbyterian, but they are
right,
great resources.
Right. So, you know, if a bigot is a person who is utterly intolerant of any, disagreement with their idea of sex and marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, we would be arguing, I think, with Gagnon that just set aside the Bible for a little bit, and this is very unhealthy to the future of humanity. And,
oh, for
and
sure.
You were back there, human dignity. Human dignity for everything, I think, would treat sex as a great gift of God and to be used in a sense and a way that is the best for all of us. And, you know, since the beginning of time, not just recently, we've had that problem. We are fast running out of time. Let's maybe try to go on with these topics and in the final one that you have for us today,
okay.
Ian. How about that Christians are just self-righteous? We think we're, so moral, so goody-goody two-shoes. And I can see where the world sees some or all of us like that. What's their thinking on that topic?
Yeah, definitely so. I do regularly experience this at the U of University of Arizona. Helpful in establishing this false belief or wrong understanding when it comes to Christianity is we have certain street preachers that make the rounds at the universities. So we have Brother Jed here. Maybe I shouldn't say his name. But I remember him all the way back when I was in the university. He simply travels the United States and travels on campus. And his message is simply to scream at people, to tell them to repent or they're going to hell, to accost them on the basis of whatever they're wearing on that day, to make remarks because they're in a fraternity or sorority, you know, all those sorts of things. So this is basically the public expression of Christianity here on campus. And it's nothing more than pure legalism, pure moralism. It's you think you're better than the rest of us. You think that you're some kind of an exalted class because you refrain from certain things, you know, those sorts of things. And so the response then generally is, and this is the way it always is with the law, and we know this, you know, theologically speaking, is if you just give somebody the law and you just accuse them, there is a place, and with many people, that will hit home. But to just give them that certainly doesn't bring them into the Christian faith, because all that is the accusation of the law. All that is the charge is, hey, you're a sinner. And because of creation, a lot of people will resonate with that and recognize, you know, yeah, there's probably something wrong here. I'm probably not a good person, they'll reason. The solution in their minds, independent of the full revelation of the scriptures, is they'll say, well, but compared to my friend, I'm actually quite good. I don't cheat on my exams. I don't cheat on my girlfriend. If there is a God out there, I'm probably better off than him. He might be going to hell, but compared to him, I'm in pretty good shape. Or the other will be just complete disbelief. You know, there's no way that could be true. And maybe to add a third here, maybe even suicide, because if you just have the law in the way Judas received it then, you know, the only out then you might conceive of is simply taking your life. And we've seen that in other people as well.
Well, you know, Ian, if you're characterizing this Pastor Jed guy correctly, yeah. And it sounds like you are, I sure wouldn't want to be a part of Christianity like that.
Oh, definitely not.
The college kids might hear this and say, well, that's what a lot of Christian preachers, the majority of them are into. And you and I would say, as for two Christian preachers, we're not into that at all. That right. mischaracterizes completely our faith, you know, because— John the Baptist, he went out there in the wilderness of people and screamed at them repentance, but he also screamed at them the coming one, the Christ, the Messiah, whose birth we're right. Looking forward to celebrating right. again this year. And that's a completely different God, isn't it? And
oh,
a
indeed.
Faith. And
indeed.
So, we're not opposed to morals, but our righteousness. Is really different than what Brother Jed is putting down, isn't it?
Oh, indeed. And that's just the point here, is that he's willing to sort of separate himself from them based on his own works and by calling them to repentance, hoping that they could join him in his religion, which is essentially all keeping the law, all moralism. It's a religion that is functionally without any need for Christ, any need for the forgiveness of sins, anything like that. And so our response, and that will be my response talking to students about Brother Jed, who will, you know, when they ask, well, what do you think of him? Is, you know, there's something to it. There is a law out there. We are under God's wrath because we have not kept the law. But what the scriptures teach is that universally we're all under sin because we're all corrupted and we're all sinners. So we're not different people. We're all the same people, and we all have the same need, which is namely the forgiveness of sins, namely the person of Jesus. And so the solution, if you can put it that way, and the proper response to the false teachings of Brother Jed is to embrace first universal sin and then also universal grace won for us in by the blood of Christ. And that's the thing that students, even when they run into Christians, typically do not hear, that there is forgiveness of sin, that God loves us to such a degree that he was willing to sacrifice his own son on our behalf. That's really the tragedy of all of this, is that they think they have Christianity, and rightly we could say they're rejecting that false version of Christianity. But because of whatever reason, they simply don't have access to the truth of the gospel. And so that's what campus ministry is about. That's what LCMSU chapters are about, is when we get into these circumstances on campus where we're interacting with students, and God willing, we get to this discussion of the law and the things we owe to God. We can also then bring to bear on this situation the truth and the reality of the forgiveness of sins and life in Christ. Because there, all these questions that we've been going through, they all come to their right understanding and their right solution. And this is an evidence of human dignity. God loved us to such a degree, he sacrifices his son for us.
I was going to say, Ian, you know, that Jesus had the Pastor Jeds in his time.
Sure.
And
absolutely.
he was really on their case,
totally.
Big time. So if the kids knew some of that Jesus was opposed to those kind of characters, then it might help. Pastor Ian Pacey, we have certainly enjoyed having you as our guest today on Cross Defense. Thank you so much. Let's have you on again. I really enjoyed this, and blessings down there at the University of Arizona.
Hey, thank you very much.
I know your kids and kids all over are going through finals this time
yeah.
of year, so blessings to all of them. I remember what it was like. And
yes.
Come back on again, will you? Will
I
you,
will,
Ian?
Definitely so.
God's blessings to you.
Thank you. God bless.
Join us next week at the same time, Mondays from 2 to 3, when we talk about these intellectual pursuits for the truth and defense of Christ. That's who we love. That's who we believe in. That's who we trust, the truth, the life. He is eternal life, believe me. So we enjoy this. If you have questions or comments, you can email us at kfuo.org. We'll pass them on to Pastor Pacey and all the rest of the people at LCMSU. God's blessings, and tune in next week when we'll talk about Christianity, the downright winner as a historical religion, with Craig Pardon here on Cross Defense.